This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, over and over on this show, we've mentioned the important role states are going to play going forward with health reform. President Obama invited all the newly elected governors to the White House and told them that states should be given room to innovate as they work with and implement parts of health reform.
Well, those are two words we love to hear on this show, health reform and innovate. But as you know, Mark, many of the newly elected governors that joined the president in the Blair House last week are Republicans, and some of them want to see the law repealed. So really important to continue to emphasize the way that states can be part of the process, since there seems to still be so much concern that this law suggests a federal overreach.
Well, there's one thing that Democrats and Republicans all agree upon is the need to support community radio stations. You know, this is our second week and the final week of the sixth annual WESU Holiday Pledge Drive. And we're a little more halfway done, Margaret. We have our goal of raising $15,000 by December 12th. And so we hope everyone gets on the phone, pulls your car over, because you don't want to be driving and calling on your cell phone, 860-685-7700. Give us a email blast at www.wesufm.org.
That is a great idea, and it is the holiday time. Good time to part with maybe a few of the dollars in your pocket for something that people love and depend on. We know Conversation listeners across the country are fans of community and college radio. You know the benefits and the pleasure that WESU provides us with hosting this show. So we're going to take this time a little bit away from reform and innovation to remind folks just how important it is to keep WESU going.
We really do support WESU, and you can support us now. Send in your contributions. You know, we have some wonderful T-shirts. I'm looking at them now. They're very hip, black with nice logos on them for the WESU, all the way to left of your dial, and we're excited about that. So give us a call at 860-685-7700.
Yeah, last year I bought one of those sweatshirts for my nephew. It became his favorite. This year he gets the long sleeve black T-shirt. But the best gift is the gift of giving community radio. It's a gift of commercial-free, creative, and free voice on the airways.
It is, and thanks to everyone who's pledged so far. We're only a little more than halfway there, as we've said, and bring us over the finish line today with your contributions. Give us a call right now at 860-685-7700.
And thanks to the incredible staff of community members and WESU students who volunteer their time to bring you these shows. We couldn't do it without them.
Now let's turn to today's guest, who's going to speak with us about an area of healthcare we don't hear enough about: behavioral health and substance abuse services. We're happy John O'Brien from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration can join us today.
And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, visit us at chcradio.com. And think about becoming a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with John O'Brien, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The child nutrition bill is on its way to President Obama's desk for approval. The House of Representatives voted to send the president a bill that would enable more poor children to receive free meals at school, raise the nutritional quality of cafeteria lunches, and reduce junk food and sugary beverages sold in school vending machines. The bill, which cleared the Senate this summer with bipartisan support, won the House with 247 Democrats and 17 Republicans voting for it. Before the House vote, Speaker Nancy Pelosi commended First Lady Michelle Obama for her support.
For recognizing a need in our country, a need for proper nutrition for our children. Children who have issues of having the proper nutrition have issues about being susceptible to diabetes.
The First Lady lobbied for the bill as a way to combat obesity and hunger. Almost half of the bill's cost, $4.5 billion, is financed by a cut in food stamps. But President Obama says he plans to find alternative ways to fund the bill without cuts to food assistance before they take effect. The nation's Healthy People 2020 has been released, and the new blueprint to improve America's health is taking social and environmental policies into consideration for the first time. The new health goals for the next 10 years encourage policies for states and communities that can help make people's surroundings more conducive to healthier lifestyles. And through a new innovative challenge this year, the Healthy People 2020 program will begin helping communities electronically compare how their residents match up to the new health goals so that they can tailor their own work for improvements.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with John O'Brien, a senior advisor at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, an agency in the Department of Health and Human Services that is working to improve the quality and availability of mental health and substance abuse services. Welcome, John. We're very interested in talking with you about the current state of mental health and substance abuse care in the country and how you think the area of healthcare will be affected by health reform. But first, perhaps you can tell our listeners exactly what your federal agency does and perhaps a bit of its history.
Sure. SAMHSA was established in 1992 by Congress, and it was established as part of a reorganization of the Federal Administration on Mental Health Services, which was formerly known as the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration. So for the past 18 years, we have worked closely with each state through our block grant program and also worked with communities through our discretionary grant program to enhance the availability of both prevention as well as mental health and substance abuse treatment services throughout the country.
John, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act focused first on coverage, getting insurance to people through Medicaid and the subsidized private insurances in the exchanges, and by eliminating denials and coverage limits. Then, secondly, it focused on transforming the delivery system. How adequate were the changes, do you think, in addressing the insurance coverage issues for individuals who need behavioral health and substance abuse services?
Some of that has yet to play out since some of the implementation dates that will affect coverage, service coverage, will not occur until 2014. The language in the legislation, though, holds significant promise. For instance, there is a provision in the law that requires that essential benefits, which are services that will be provided by qualified health plans through the state exchanges, must include mental health and substance abuse treatment services. In addition, there are a number of other services that are directly and indirectly related to mental health and substance abuse treatment that are also going to be required as part of the coverage of those plans.
You know, John, the clinical focus in healthcare reform was redesigning primary care, improving quality and safety, and reducing hospitalizations and readmissions. But inherent in this, of course, is mental health and substance abuse care. But this area didn't seem to get as much explicit attention, particularly given the fact that behavioral health issues are said to underlie about half of the encounters that we have in primary care. Your thoughts on that?
A number of thoughts. And Mark, you are correct. There is a significant number of both hospitalizations and trips to the emergency room that are often related to either a mental health issue or a substance use issue. Data from a number of studies has indicated in some instances it's as high as 15% to 17% of all admissions are mental health or substance abuse related as it relates to EDs. And a significant number of hospitalizations are also mental health or substance abuse related. The reasons, of course, for those admissions, whether it's the emergency room or hospital, vary. But a significant portion of those are directly related to individuals who don't have insurance. And therefore, they use the emergency room and they use hospitals as their primary care vehicles. And both in terms of some of the provisions that are in the Affordable Care Act, as well as some of SAMHSA's programs, are trying to change the tide of use of both emergency rooms and hospitalizations for behavioral health issues. And therefore, we're looking at, as well as our other partners within HHS, looking at models that are going to work for primary care and behavioral health integration. I think it's important, again, to remember, since many of these individuals have not had insurance, many of them have not had a relationship with a primary care doctor. And so key to making sure that there's coverage, first and foremost, key to the success, I think, of the Affordable Care Act for our constituents is to make sure that folks establish relationships with their primary care provider. It doesn't always have to be a physician, but provider, and be able to use that individual, be able to use that healthcare providers in ways that they haven't before. I think an important fact is that those individuals that have substance abuse and those individuals that have a mental illness tend to have other chronic conditions. And so, again, it's important that they have access to health care, because that will really help in terms of addressing some of those other chronic conditions in addition to their behavioral health needs.
And John, I think we're going to try and explore those models in a moment a little bit further. But first, I'd like to ask you about SAMHSA's plan of action going forward over these next couple of years. I understand you've laid out 8 strategic initiatives that are designed to reduce the toll and the burden of mental illness and substance abuse on individuals and communities around the country. Can you highlight a few of these initiatives for our listeners and perhaps also comment on any concerns about how they are likely to fare in the current context of the state budget deficits?
The few that I think are most noteworthy are certainly the prevention strategic initiative. And when we talk about prevention, we certainly talk about the prevention of use of both alcohol as well as other substances, as well as the promotion of emotional wellness. And so our initiative that's focused on prevention really does look at working with both states and communities where individuals, families, schools, faith-based organizations are going to take action to promote emotional health and reduce the likelihood of substance abuse and reduce the likelihood of mental illness. Obviously, the Health Reform Implementation Initiative is first and foremost in my mind because of my role, and there are a lot of things that SAMHSA, as well as our HHS partners, are looking at as well in order to be able to provide access to better health and behavioral health services. We have our Health Information Technology Strategic Initiative, and the extent that we can get providers and individuals that consume services to use health information technology in order to be able to be more efficient and more accurate about the information that's available to healthcare providers.
Today we're speaking with John O'Brien, a senior advisor at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. Now, John, SAMHSA has a well-deserved reputation for engaging consumers in its planning and programming. And I know you've encouraged public engagement and feedback on the development of your new strategic plan. One theme that emerged that was of interest was the concern about the behavioral health workforce. And I think we all know that on the medical side, there is an acute shortage looming. And from our own experience running a community health center, we're very aware of the shortages that are existing in for psychiatrists and therapists and the like. Was this addressed at all under health reform? And is there a national effort underway in the professional schools and training programs to address this?
A great question, Mark. Yes. Interestingly enough, when we started the strategic initiatives back in spring, there were 10 of them, and one of them was workforce. And after much discussion, both with our stakeholders, which included both our provider community and our consumer groups and organizations in recovery, as well as our other HHS partners, we felt that workforce was part of many of the other initiatives, so that it didn't make sense to necessarily have a standalone workforce initiative, but that is part of healthcare reform. We needed to think about the workforce implications there. As part of trauma and justice, we needed to think about, you know, a workforce that understood those issues there as well. Obviously, some of the work that's being done by HHS, especially through HRSA, who has received a significant amount of funding for increasing the behavioral health workforce and as well as the healthcare workforce, will be rolled out over the next 6 months to a year. But we also believe, and SAMHSA's put a significant amount of effort in this over the past decade, the ability for peer workers, those individuals that have a shared recovery experience, to be able to perform a number of activities, provide a number of services that individuals with behavioral health needs.
John, I'd like to now go to that the issue of innovative models. And certainly one promising area for better access and effectiveness of care is this co-location and integration of primary care and behavioral health, both by co-locating behavioral health within the primary medical care area, but also the reverse, bringing the primary care provider into the behavioral health or substance abuse treatment area. Tell us about this initiative. What's the state of the science on outcomes, and what further policy changes might be needed to accomplish this change?
Let me give you a little background of what we're doing here and then get the outcomes and the policy piece. We've been fortunate enough, SAMHSA's been fortunate enough over the past year and a half to have implemented our primary care and behavioral health integration project. And the way that we approach primary care and behavioral health is what we call bidirectional, so that it is not just behavioral health professionals or behavioral health staff located in a primary care clinic or a federally qualified health center or even a rural health center, but it's also having experienced and trained primary care clinicians, and not only just doctors, but nurses, physicians, extenders, et cetera, in behavioral health organizations. In many instances, a significant portion of the population that have mental health or substance use disorder needs see their treatment providers, so their mental health centers, their substance abuse treatment providers, as their health homes, as their medical homes. In many instances, those organizations have actually employed medical staff who have provided general health care, primary care, to those individuals. So we feel like it needs to be a balanced kind of bidirectional approach, and it is that bidirectional approach that not only SAMHSA is advocating for and also investing our energies and resources, but some of the other federal agencies. The outcomes are significant. One is, if we just think about it from the prevention perspective, having primary care physicians or primary care staff begin to screen people when they walk in the door for mental illness and or for substance use disorders is huge. And the ability to be able to do some prevention, to do some early identification, will have some longer-lasting effects in terms of the costs for these services and costs for general health care services over time, but also a significant improvement in the people's lives. Second, we also see that by providing primary care to these individuals, we're at least some of the initial results from our SAMHSA's efforts has shown that providing primary care has made significant changes in people's blood pressure, in terms of their body mass index, and in terms of some of their other health indicators. You may or may not know this, but individuals, especially with mental illness, tend to die 25 years younger than their general counterparts. And we're hoping that in 10 years, we're going to actually increase that number by 10 years. With the improvements that are afforded under the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that's a very important goal. John, implementing health reform is largely going to be left up to the states, or they're at least going to be the starting point for it. And in addition to continuing the work that SAMHSA does with the public and private sector, how do you plan to work with the states on developing strategies for implementing some of the new provisions under health reform?
We are, you know, we work very closely with our states, our state mental health administrators, our state substance abuse authorities. We believe that it's those individuals, in particular those organizations, have some very significant content knowledge that's going to be very helpful to those other agencies that are designing the state health insurance exchanges. In some cases, that will be the Medicaid agency. In other cases, it's going to be the insurance commissioner. In others, it may actually be a newly established freestanding entity. But again, states are going to be critical in the rollout and the implementation around health care reform. We recently just finished a roadmap for our state mental health authorities and our state substance abuse authorities that identified 8 or 9 steps that they should be thinking about now, meaning over the next 12 months, as they get ready to work with their partners at the state level to begin to design their health care reform systems. Now, we know that there are a number of things that we don't know around health care reform, just because the regulations and also some of the discussions haven't occurred that will give some additional guidance to states around implementing health care reform. As that information becomes available, we plan again on updating that roadmap so that our state mental health and substance abuse authorities can take full advantage of how to best implement health care reform in their states.
Very exciting. And John, we'd like to ask all of our guests this question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
To the best that your listeners can keep an eye on SAMHSA in terms of some of our innovations, I think that would be tremendously important. But I think kind of going back to some of the earlier questions that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are going to be critical in this health care reform process. And I think that some of the innovations that are going to be coming out of their shop, as a matter of fact, they just created a shop on innovations, are going to be tremendously important. So between SAMHSA and I think the CMS, that would be a great place for your listeners to keep tracking it.
Today, we've been speaking with John O'Brien, a senior advisor at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. Thank you so much for joining us today, John. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's Bright Idea focuses on Health Leads, a nonprofit organization that goes beyond prescribing medications to tackle urban patients' health problems at their source. The idea for Health Leads developed back in 1996 when Rebecca Oney, then a Harvard undergraduate, began working in the housing unit at the Greater Boston Legal Services. There she witnessed firsthand the connections between poverty and health problems, and doctors struggling to give low-income patients the comprehensive care they needed. In an effort to fill these gaps, Oney founded Health Leads in the Boston Medical Center Pediatrics Department with the help of Dr. Barry Zuckerman. For the last 15 years, doctors who have partnered with Health Leads have been writing their patients' prescriptions for a wide variety of community resources, such as affordable housing, adequate food, and job training. Student volunteers stationed at family help desk in hospital waiting rooms then work with patients to connect them with the services they need. This can mean everything from directing patients to local food pantries and soup kitchens to helping them sign up for a reduced price child care program. In addition to linking patients to crucial resources, these student volunteers are also learning valuable skills that Health Leads hopes will shape them into the healthcare leaders of tomorrow. In 2010, 83% of Health Lead graduates entered jobs or graduate studies in the field of health and poverty, with 94% of them reporting that Health Leads had a high or very high impact on their postgraduate plans. One alumnae, Mia Lozado, now a resident at the University of California, San Francisco, explained, "My classmates think you write a prescription and you're done. I ask, Can the patient read the prescription? Does she have the health insurance to fill it? Does she need transportation to the pharmacy? Does she have food at home to take with the prescription? Health Leads currently has 600 undergraduate volunteers working with over 5,000 families. Since its start in Boston, the organization has expanded its reach to Baltimore, New York City, Providence, Rhode Island, and Washington, D.C., and aims to reach over 23,000 families by 2014. By connecting urban patients with local resources they need to stay healthy, Health Leads' holistic approach to care moves beyond treatment to tackle illness and disease where they begin in our communities. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.